The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Folks, welcome to Hour 2. You always know it's Hour 2 because it follows Hour 1 absolutely every time. I'm talking to Curtis Sliwa. I hope he will be the next mayor of New York City. That would be great for the city. It would be great for the country. It would be amazing. Curtis, welcome back. I want to talk to you. You were just describing de Blasio as a Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Jadrul, Ganef. I don't know what New York words we can use, but he's every one of them. We've never seen anybody like de Blasio. I mean, it's just a fact. I've never seen anyone like him. You know, he killed the groundhog, right? You remember this?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Groundhog Day. He does an appearance with the groundhog. He's so tall. He's so freakishly minute bowl tall. He drops the groundhog. And from that height, the groundhog is brained and dies. DOA, they put over the sheet, the chalk marks. He killed the groundhog. He ate pizza with a knife and fork. You know, if you're looking for New York optics, okay. So it's hard to comprehend that not only is he that kind of a guy, but he's a kind of a guy who he seems to shoot himself in the foot every time he seems to be. I mean, to pick a fight with Cuomo, who should be his ally. But let's flip it around. Do you think that him and AOC attacking Cuomo and others will bring Cuomo down? Do you think Cuomo will survive this?
He's very weak. And if you have to take out
Cuomo. And stupid like Fredo.
Yeah. You cannot allow him to get off the mat. He will come back with a vengeance. He knows where de Blasio, AOC, and all of his Democratic amigos' bones are buried and who buried them. So they better do the deed now. Either force him to resign with overwhelming evidence that he just can't dispute, or just do what they tried to do to then President Donald Trump in the U.S. Senate, tried twice to impeach him in the Senate, couldn't. They have that same ability in the state legislature and the state Senate to impeach Andrew Cuomo. And they better push for that process, because if he has any breath left in his system, he will come back. He will seek vengeance, even if it destroys the Democratic Party. That's the way Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo is. And you look at his eyes, Eric, and he is evil. It's the Maluk.
I can't believe it. We had to do an extra segment so that you could bring that up. There's a lot of, you got to understand, we've got housewives in Texas. They have no idea what you just said. But you know what? We don't have time to explain. It's the evil eye. Look, let me ask you, Curtis, because just for background, where did you grow up and what is your ethnicity? Like, how do you get a name like Curtis Sliwa?
Background, blue-collar working-class household in Canarsie, Brooklyn. My father was a merchant seaman for 55 years. My mother, Francesca, raised three of us. I have two sisters. And obviously, my mother, Barese, on the Italian side. So that's why you hear some of the Barese dialect from me. My father, Polish, from Chicago. And between the both of them, they were my role models. They always taught me, look, where there's a will, there's a way, Curtis. As a Roman Catholic growing up, they said, poverty will bring you closer to God. They always looked to the nuns. They said, look how the nuns are chaste. Then they would look at the priests in the rectory and they'd say, see how ostentatious they are. I was brought up to believe in selfless service as the route of being bonded with God. And as you can see, it served me well all through my life. 42 years as leader of the Guardian Angels in 13 countries now, 130 cities, all volunteers, risking our lives in a good Samaritan way to protect people, most of them whom we don't even know. So that's been my guiding principle. And also, remember when you mentioned Ed Koch, who was my nemesis, he had me arrested 76 times.
I didn't know anything about this. Is it why was he your nemesis? Like, why? What is wrong with this guy that he would be, you know, bug? Because you're like you're a vigilante. Is this his idea?
Well, that Hell's Angels, you know, a street gang. He just couldn't accept that the city was in such dire circumstance that the city was embracing the guardian angels. So I ended up getting wooden shampoos, concrete facials.
When you say this, I mean, I die. This is why you got to write a book. Wooden shampoos. Again, what do you mean by that? You're talking about cops allowed to whack you in the head with a billy club. You're telling me.
Oh yeah. Their union was telling them you got to make sure that the guardian angels are not riding the trains and patrolling the streets. A concrete facial. I don't know, Eric, if you ever had a police officer grab you and then all of a sudden say, hey, you see that curb there? Watch. Boom. And then all of a sudden you have a big lump on your head. And then they would lock me up in Rikers Island and all the local correctional facilities and lose my paperwork. Now, can you imagine what it was like for me behind bars in a dormitory with 40 guys who wanted to kill me? You could just imagine what that was like, Eric. But, you know, I took a licking and came back ticking, shot by the mob. You know, Gotti and the Gambino shot me 5 times with hollow point bullets. Then broke my jaw battling the looters on June 1st and June 2nd in the city when the cops were told to stand down. No, no.
Wait. You're talking recently?
I don't retreat.
The looters recently?
Yeah, June 1st, June 2nd. Remember when anarchy prevailed in the streets of New York?
No, I don't remember. I'm a little out of touch up here on the Upper East Side because, you know, I'm doing my writing and then I go to LaGuardia and I travel around the country. So I'm a little bit out of touch. I had no idea that you were involved in – God bless you, Curtis. That is so fantastic. The last time you were on the show, you told the story of getting shot. And if we have you on another time, you should just tell it again because it's one of the most – amazing stories. I just have to say that you have to have some God, some concept that God has his hand on your life. What you have been through, frankly, you shouldn't have gotten through. You shouldn't take a licking and keep on ticking. After a few lickings like you've gotten, I would say you wouldn't be ticking anymore. It's kind of amazing to me.
Eric, both my parents, they're no longer here, but they raised me and they said, Curtis, do good things for people. And good things will happen to you. Don't ask when, where, or why. I tell you, I've been in some real dire circumstances, Eric, but I always believed what my parents taught me. And I believe that's really the route for New York City. If we can do good things for people who have lost, they have hopelessness, despair, no self-esteem, everything will be elevated. That's why I've got to be the cheerleader. I've got to rally people in the city who are so depressed because all they've been subjected to is Cuomo pounding them, de Blasio pounding them and holding everything back. So I got to be able to release, resurrect the city like Lazarus from the dead and allow it once again to become the crown jewel of the world with all the entertainment, the culture, the financial ability that we've had, because we are the crown jewel of the world. Right now we're tarnished and it's like somebody robbed the crown jewel out of the crown, and I'm going to restore it to its grandeur and its greatness. And the way people help me, Eric, they got to help me do that. Go to the website. We just put it up. CurtisSliwaForMayor.com.
Okay. Sliwa is S-L-I-W-A. I want people to get that. CurtisSliwaForMayor.com. Curtis, I really hope that people listening to this program, whether the New Yorkers or wherever they are, that they will understand certain battles are national battles. The battle for the mayor in New York City, this is not the alderman in Westchester. This is a big thing. It affects the whole world. We have seen it. I mean, people who come to New York now under de Blasio, they just think, what happened to this amazing city? You know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was booming. And what happened to it? I also think, Curtis, that, you know, when you talk about being a cheerleader, that's something I think is true of every politician, but it's particularly true of the mayors of New York. The better mayors of this city have had an ability to really connect. And I think it's absolutely key. So Curtis Sliwa for mayor.com. I know that people are going to help you. And if Katsimatidis doesn't help you, I'm going to get in his face with some Greek stuff. I got some secret Greek stuff that I'm going to tell him we got to do. Curtis, anything we can do on this program to help you We'd love to have you back again. You just let us know if you're making an announcement or whatever. I know you probably don't need our help, but we're here to help. Folks, go to Curtis Sliwa for mayor.com. This city needs the help. Curtis, God bless you and to be continued.
We'll continue the fight for what we know is right.
Thank you.
Once there was a way to get back home, sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I?
Hey folks, as promised, Bob Woodson. Bob, welcome back.
Pleased to be back, Eric.
You're one of these people. You just cheer me up. Just knowing you exist, you're in the world here. I want to tell people how to find you. They can go to Woodson Center. What's the website?
WoodsonCenter.org or 1776unites.com.
Okay. I just want to mention that.
WoodsonCenter.org or 1776unites.com.
Okay. All right, Bob. Some people know you, some people don't. You've been involved in civil rights for many decades now. When did you get involved? Like what year, seriously, did you start working in this, caring about these things?
1964. I was about 24 years old. I took over a civil rights organization in Westchester, Pennsylvania. It's about 30 miles west of Philadelphia, the home of Baird Rustin.
The home of Baird Rustin?
Yes, Baird Rustin is from Westchester. There's a school named for him. And Baird used to come through with Dr. King and others. And so I was, I had unseated an older leader and took over the Westchester Human Relations Council, which was the leading civil rights organization at the time.
Wow. So you met Baird Rustin and Dr. King?
Yes, I met Dr. King once, but Baird Rustin many times when he came through. What people don't realize is that national civil rights leaders came through and brought the media attention to local issues. But what they were supporting is our fight to desegregate the schools and then the housing. And so that would attack the press. And so that's how it worked.
All right. So, Bob, look, you've got it. Tremendous history. You seem too young to have been that old in 1964, but just the idea that you have seen how, whatever we want to call it, the civil rights movement, whatever it is, how it has changed over the years and how it had a Christian base, it had biblical values, deep respect for the family, for the father in Black families. And you have seen how all of that has changed very, very dramatically. Even Senator Moynihan, way back, liberal Democratic Senator Moynihan wrote that paper on how it was the destruction of Black families and the loss of Black fathers, that was killing the Black community. And people even then were saying, shut up, we don't want to hear about this, that's divisive, that's what, I don't know what were they saying? This is a cultural difference that, you know, Black families are supposed to be broken and we don't want to address that. I mean, it seems to me like soft racism.
It is a soft bigotry of low expectation, but it's also undermining. It's very interesting. Tom Saul points out in his work that the biggest reduction in poverty in the Black community occurred between 1940 and 1960. It went from like 82% down to about 45% in 1950. And from 1950 to 1965, it went down to about 20%.
Okay, excuse me. You're talking about the reduction of poverty in the Black community. So in 1960, we were better than ever in terms of the poverty level being so low in the Black communities in the United States in 1960.
60 it was. And also the Black family was 85% of Black households had, or 80% had a man and a woman raising children. So the Black family, the marriage rate in the Black community at the end of slavery, you've certainly Our scholars looked at six major plantations. 75% of all Black families, even in slavery, had a man and a woman raising children. And then they rushed to marry legally right afterwards. And so this marriage, so for a century, the Black community throughout segregation and the end of slavery maintained strong two-parent households. Even though in the 1930 to 1940, our marriage rate was higher than any other group in society. And it was the foundation of faith, self-determination, and the family that was the strongest antidote to slavery and discrimination and racism. But all of that changed in the 60s with the poverty programs. In other words, what racism and slavery and discrimination could not do for 100 years, government intervention in the poverty programs ended up destabilizing that community. And as a consequence of the destabilization of the family, separating work from income in the 60s, making welfare more attractive than marriage, you saw the deterioration of that community. And so the out of wedlock births began to soar to the point where now 70% of all children are born out of wedlock in those communities. So it was, and I documented the deterioration of this.
It's unbelievable. Is there a good book that people can read that gives them this history?
Read anything that Thomas Sowell wrote. Fred Siegel's book, The Future Once Happened Here, is excellent. Gives you an excellent description of how Cloward and Piven, two sociologists at the Columbia University School of Social Work, they were socialists, and their goal was to destabilize, to promote income redistribution in America. And the way you do that is to flood the system with Black, using Blacks to flood into the welfare system. So you had millions of Blacks coming into the welfare system in the 70s at a time when the unemployment rate in New York for Black men was under 4%.
It's unbelievable. I guess, you know, we have to talk about BLM. BLM, I always say, BLM is a Marxist organization that is harming Blacks in America. If you care about Black people in America, you need to understand that BLM is harming them. But guilty white people who don't have the guts to look at the facts or the guts to speak the truth, they go right along. They're giving money to BLM. They're putting it on their social media. And they're actually harming Blacks. But they care less about actually helping Blacks than they do about virtue signaling that they look like they're not racist.
Absolutely. And the very fact that the most severe problem facing low-income Blacks is crime. And so what Black Lives Matter and the social justice warriors, they have this assault on defund the police. And as a consequence, it means that the policing in those communities has declined, with the consequence that the murder rate is soaring in those communities. And yet, when you look at what are the remedies that are being proposed by this administration, they're talking, and companies led by Black Lives Matter, they're talking about having numerical quotas for allowing more Blacks on boards of directors, or more Blacks numerically in these companies. What does that have to do, or addressing systemic racism, what does that have to do with reducing violence in these communities? It's a kind of bait and switch game where you use the demographics of those that are hurting most as the bait. And when the remedies arrive, the switch occurs and the money goes to people who are not suffering the problem. And that's why this is such an outrage that we should be talking about systemic racism. I don't even know what that is.
Well, listen, you're a Black man, and so you can say that, but you don't need to be Black to see what's going on. I mean, as an American who does not define myself or identify as a person of color, I still care about what happens in those communities because those are my fellow Americans. And I am and have been for a long time really sick at what I see. And so I really treasure people like you who are willing to speak out on this, because it is so hard to find good information on this. And the Democratic Party, I just feel like they've sold their souls. If you care about communities, urban communities, you've got to know that what we've been doing since Lyndon Johnson has actually hurt them. Why can't we simply admit that we've made some mistakes? If you actually care about people, isn't that the moral thing to do?
But let me challenge you on something, Eric. I really believe that, I hope that white people get the courage to speak out against this outrage. I don't agree with you that only blacks are eligible to speak out. I just think white people have, I hope, that they have race fatigue, you know.
Well, no, I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying this is the absurdity of it, is that people act like I don't have the right. I mean, William right. Wilberforce, who was a white man, an Englishman, obviously gave his whole life to help African slaves. He said, this is my duty. God has called me to this. Today, you have people saying like, well, we don't want help from a white guy. And you just think, What are we even talking about? It's just, it's a level of madness. We're going to go to a break. Folks, please find Bob Woodson. Go to woodsoncenter.org. Look it up. Share woodsoncenter.org with your friends. Go to 1776unites.com. 1776unites.com. We'll be right back. Folks, I'm talking to my friend Bob Woodson of the Woodson Center, woodsoncenter.org. Bob, I know that they wanted you to name the Woodson Center with your last name because you are technically old enough to be able to do this right now. If I named something the Metaxas Center, it wouldn't be right. But at a certain point, you're able to get away with that kind of stuff. So the woodsoncenter.org. Let's talk about reparations. Is there anybody with half a brain who really thinks this is a good idea? I mean, it seems to me there's certain things that are just flat out crazy. This is, to me, one of those ideas. Like, I just think, I don't even know who is serious about this.
No, it is crazy because the assumption is, first of all, you're trying to monetize pain and suffering that occurred hundreds of years ago. And then, of course, the obvious fact is you have Native American, the five civilized Native American tribes, they own 5,000 slaves. Well, do their descendants pay? We had free blacks who owned slaves. Well, do their descendants pay? I mean, it gets so ridiculous, but also it reduces that to a transaction. I mean, a friend of mine, Richard Watts, has two books, Entitlemania, And in that book, he talks about how the detrimental effect that just people leaving money in their wills to their children, when children, even of the wealthy whites, get unearned money, it devastates them and often because the parents cannot convey to those students the values and enthusiasm and passion it took to create the wealth. But they just give them the wealth and it corrupts them. It's like people winning the lottery. It is so. So it is important for people to know what you do with money and how it's received. But just giving money in recompense for slavery and discrimination is harmful. It is harmful.
I mean, it's harmful on so many levels. First of all, it's insulting to me as an American that somebody's going to say, literally, because of the color of my skin, I owe money. You know, it just becomes absurd. My relatives, of course, were in Europe suffering their own misery. So it just becomes really silly. And in this country, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had a black president for one or two terms. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but we had a black president. We've had some of the most wealthy, successful, influential people in the culture, whether you're talking about Michael Jackson and Oprah Winfrey or Michael Jordan or whatever. We've had just tremendously successful people, black people. The list is endless. So the idea that we're going to push this victim mentality. Again, it's why I'm talking to you, because you have spent your life fighting against the victim mentality.
Yeah, and what's even more lethal is that nothing is worse than providing people a good excuse for failure. I mean, I would prefer old-fashioned bigotry. Frankly, it was easier to confront old-fashioned bigotry because there was at least a level of respect. But nothing is worse than being patronized. That liberal white guilt assumes that the fate of Black America rests with whatever whites do or do not do. And that is, and so that is the most corrupt and thing that I can ever think of. And that's why, but it is a bait and switch game. And that's a part that bothers me, that the people who are advocating, for instance, defund the police, they are living in safe and secure communities. They don't have to suffer the consequence of their advocacy. And that's why, but if you look at the polls in the Black community, 82% of Blacks living in these troubled communities, they are against defunding the police. When surveys were taken of Blacks and about to what extent is racial discrimination a principal barrier to your life, 62% said just sometimes. It isn't the primary barrier that I face. So who are these extremists on the left? Who are they representing? They're not representing the people suffering the problem. In fact, they are creating the problem that they're getting paid to cure.
It seems also that what the Democratic Party has done over the years is they have gotten people dependent on them, in a sense. In other words, they promise things, they don't deliver. In other words, they clearly have not, in six decades, spending trillions of dollars, they have not improved the lot of minority urban communities. I mean, it seems like that alone would tell you that at least we could say they're not helping with the trillions and trillions of dollars. They're not helping. But I would argue that the way they don't help is by keeping people in this perpetual cycle. And I know you've talked about this before. It's a mentality. And it's why I have you on this program, because I really think that in the culture, we don't hear from folks like you, who you've come up through this. You've seen both sides. You've seen every side of it. And you're a patriotic American. You love this country. And you want to help. I want to talk about 1776 Unites again, because that's something that people need to hear about that in the few minutes we have left.
You know, the 1619 was that a series of essays that the New York Times produced that really denigrates the country. And they use America's birth defect of slavery as a bludgeon to kind of destabilize and undermine the country. So we assembled 23 plus scholars and activists, and we put together, we send the legitimate birthday of America 1776, and we have produced aspirational, inspirational content.
Bob, forgive me, I didn't realize what time it was. When we come back, I will let you go on this. Folks, go to 1776unites.com. We'll be right back with Bob Woodson. Folks, welcome back. I'm talking to Bob Woodson of the Woodson Center. You can go to woodsoncenter.org or 1776unites.com. Bob, I cut you off before we went to a break. Please continue talking about 1776unites.com.
The Woodson Center and 1776 Project is solution-oriented. We must stop this fatalistic preoccupation, and because solutions to all of these problems exist within the same zip code as the problems. And so what we have in these essays, we've developed curriculum. We've lessons that we've released. We had 9,000 downloads in a few weeks. And so if you go to our website, you can learn about how the fact is, historically, when whites were at their worst, Blacks were at their best. We developed railroads. We established Wall Streets. We built hotels, medical schools, hospitals. We all of this in a free enterprise system. There were Blacks who were born slaves, who died millionaires. The American people need to know that this is one of the greatest countries in the world. We're the only country to have an Emancipation Proclamation and fought and died to end slavery. And so in 1776, our series of essays, you'll meet scholars and activists that celebrates this country and attacks the whole victim's mentality and really promotes, I think, an inspirational presentation of America's promise. That's why people of color from all over the world risk their life to get here.
Well, you know what? There's a couple of things we didn't mention. You know, when we talk about the 1619 Project, this never really occurred to me to think of it this way. The idea that people would want to damn America because there was slavery here, was there any country in the world, any country in Europe, mention one, that did not have slavery? Slavery was, you know, it was like oxygen. Every single society had it. So to go back to 1619 and to point your finger at the colonies, I think to myself, what about England? What about Brazil? What about France? What about, I mean, every single country had slavery. So it's really historical ignorance that it even allows people to make these points and in the pages of the New York Times.
It really is. And right now, teachers, this cancel culture, where teachers are being discouraged from teaching the children the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, there's just really an assault on our values and this nation. And the Black Lives Matter, as a fact, is hostile to the nuclear family. All of the very values that enabled Black America to survive and thrive, the family, self-determination, and our Christian faith. The fact that Black Lives Matter is burning books in Portland, Oregon, and defaming the Christian cross as a symbol of white supremacy, and yet they're saying they're acting on behalf of justice for Blacks. They don't care about Black folks. They're just using them as surrogates in their efforts to destabilize this nation. They want to see all of what we have created. They want to see it destroyed. That's their goal. They want to destroy us. And I think Black folks are going to be the salvation of this country because low-income Blacks are the sleeping giant. When they wake up and find out how they're being used and abused, I think you're going to see a rebellion take place. And the Woodson Center is doing everything we can to promote this kind of pushback from this assault on our nation that Black America's fought in every war in this country ever had. And we didn't do so to protect slavery. We did so in fulfillment of America's promise.
People have to speak up. I mean, this is the thing. And I especially think about my liberal, guilty white friends. They do not have the courage. And you know what I think it is, Bob? Seriously, I think that especially if you're a Christian, you know you're a sinner, right? So I don't have some idea like, ooh, I'm guilty. Forget it. Jesus died on the cross for my sins. And so he wants me to own my sins, but to get past them. There are some people that they're not there and they think it's virtuous to kind of wallow in their guilt and to slink around and you know, not say anything because who are they to say anything, whatever. It's kind of a perpetual mindset. And I really think that people of faith need to know that we're all guilty. And Black people are exactly as guilty as white people in the eyes of God. And they are as blessed and sacred in the eyes of God. And so this mentality is fundamentally unbiblical, but they're not hearing this. So this is why I want to have you on. I want people everywhere in America, homeschoolers, go to 1776unites.com. Print this stuff out. Share it. Classical Christian schools, any school needs to use this information to combat the lies. These are destructive lies. If you care about minorities in America, you're going to have to do the right thing. You're going to have the guts to speak against BLM and speak against these destructive policies. Bob, what can people do besides go to your websites right now? Because this stuff is just, it's really, it's tragic.
Well, they certainly can contribute, but also we've gotten calls from associations of lawyers, accountants, and just today they called and said, Bob, what can we do? I said, we've got quite a few of our groups in these cities have business incubator facilities in low-income communities, and they could use some hands-on help. I just think what we're trying to do is we must de-racialize race and desegregate poverty. We're bringing together J.D. Vance and Clarence Page in Cincinnati, Ohio, to begin to talking about an alliance between low-income Blacks and low-income whites. I think that that people on both sides use race to help destabilize people. But white America, low-income white America, and low-income Black America have more in common in terms of the challenges that they face than they have in their differences. Because there's a crisis in content and meaning that's causing inner city people to die from homicide and wealthy people in Silicon Valley to die from homicide, The suicide rate there is 6 times the national average. Yes. So we have got to put race aside in order to help come up with solutions to that hole that's in the heart of many of our young people that's causing them to take a life or to take their own life.
Right.
It's the same, different sides of the same coin. But we'll never solve that problem if we continue to engage in tribal warfare.
We're going to leave it there. We'll be right back. Final segment with Bob Woodson. Folks, go to 1776unites.com. Folks, welcome back. I'm talking to Bob Woodson of the Woodson Center. Please go to woodsoncenter.org. Check it out. Use the resources, woodsoncenter.org. Please go to 1776unites.com. Use those resources. Bob, before we continue the conversation, I want to remind my viewers we're doing a fundraiser with Food for the Poor. Folks, we want everybody to participate. It's an amazing organization. They're helping people going through a tough time. They're reputable. We got to give back. We know that. Go to our website, metaxastalk.com. Click on the banner. We need everybody to do something. Bob, what should we talk about in our remaining moments together?
I would like to spend a little time talking about that my book, Lessons from the Least of These. What I've done is taking 40 years experiences I've had of walking in these low-income communities and working with grassroots leaders who have come up with solutions in the face of these troubled communities. It's an inspirational, aspirational book. It's called Lessons from the Least of These. It's available on Amazon because it'll acquaint you with the Woodson principles. I've distilled 10 principles that explains how people are able to find redemption, restoration, and recovery in some of the most difficult circumstances that people face. Because people are motivated, Eric, when they are exposed to victories that are possible, not constantly reminding them of injuries to be avoided. So if you want to know and learn about how people have overcome difficult circumstances, how they have triumphed in the face of oppression, go buy the book.
Lessons from the Least of These. Lessons from the Least of These by Bob Woodson. How long has that been out, Bob? I don't remember when that came out.
December 15th.
Oh, it's that new?
Yes.
And we're waiting till the final segment to plug it, for crying out loud. Lessons from the Least of These, Bob Woodson. Seriously, Bob, I just have a passion to get good information out to people. It's why I do the program. But people need to do something. People need to understand you have homework, folks. If you can, go to 1776unites.com. Check out the resources. Go to woodsoncenter.org. Share these links with friends. You may think of somebody that you can share this with. Send them an email. Send them a text. Share this video with them. And the book, of course, Lessons from the Least of These. Bob, when we have you back soon, I just want to focus on that book, Lessons from the Least of These, because people need to know about this book. I know during COVID times, it's been tough to launch a book. I came out with a book a year ago called Seven More Men. And one of the stories in there is George Washington Carver. I have never in my life been so moved. This black man is one of the great heroes of America. I've never encountered anything like his story. So I wrote about it in my book, but because of COVID and everything, I haven't been able to get out and do a lot of speaking on it. And I know that's the case with your book, Lessons from the Least of These. We've just got to get these things out to people. Educators need to read these things. Folks, we've got responsibilities here to take stock of stuff, figure out what's going on. Bob, I keep forgetting what city you're in.
Washington, D.C.
Never heard of it. Are you behind the razor wire, or you're outside the razor wire?
I'm outside the razor wire.
Thank God. Thank God. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for everything you're doing. I got to meet you because of the Colson Center, because of Chuck Colson and the Colson Center. And you're one of these people. When I finally met you, I thought, how have I not known you before? So I thank God for the Colson Center, John Stone Street. And I thank God for you. We'll have you back just to talk about the book Lessons from the Least of These by Bob Woodson. Folks, please go to woodsoncenter.org and 1776unites.com. Bob Woodson, God bless you, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Bless you, and thanks for having me on, Eric.